There are some people in this world who do not take half measures. One of those people is Asia Brasu.
I listened to all the Beatles albums because I liked the first one, so I have to finish all of them.
She also does this with books.
I read all Sherlock Holmes novels and short stories.
And just last week, Asia completed something that to me sounds a little alarming. She decided to listen to every single episode of Planet Money ever made. We occasionally hear from other people who have done this. For the record, no one on our team has.
I guess my first question that I have to ask is, like, are you okay? That's so much Planet Money to listen to.
You know, 6 months ago, I gave up. And after doing that, I saw how many pieces I have left, which was 300. And I said to myself, I can do it and I will do it.
We've done just about 900 episodes here at Planet Money. And honestly, sometimes it feels like there is nothing left to make a show about. So I wanted to ask Asia, in all of that time, all of those episodes, what are some things that we have never talked about?
I don't know. I don't think there is any episode about theme parks.
Theme parks? We've missed theme parks.
What about the cost of moving?
Good one.
Submarines? I don't think submarines.
So I guess there are still a few things left to cover.
There's always something to cover. Always.
Asia is right. There is always something left to cover. And sometimes we ask you, the listeners, to help us find it. Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Sally Helm. Today on the show, we take your questions. Your questions about RVs, airplane life vests, and a whole different system for paying rent. Still no submarines, though. We're saving them for later.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from TIAA. In the past 3 years, TIAA has shared $10 billion in profits, not with shareholders, but with participants, TIAA retirement plan customers. And for years, it's provided personalized financial advice at no extra cost, regardless of the size of their accounts. TIAA gives back to participants so participants can give back to the world. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Hey, Asma.
Hey, Tamara.
We are the NPR Politics Podcast.
This week, Paul Manafort is on trial.
He, of course, is President Trump's former campaign chairman.
So when there's news from that trial, the NPR Politics Pod Squad will run out of the courtroom and bring you what you need to know.
All right, Sarah Gonzalez. I had to bring you into the studio to imagine a world that is really kind of unimaginable.
A world where everyone who wants a job has a job.
Yes. We got a question about this from Chris Jeffries on Twitter, and he said, hey, what would it be like if we had 0% unemployment in the U.S. for a few years? And, Sarah, this sounds like a great world.
It sounds good.
Just no. It's no. It's not. Oh, man. I just can't even wrap my head around it.
This is Heidi Scherholz. She's a labor economist at the Economic Policy Institute in D.C., and she used to be the chief economist at the Department of Labor under President Obama. So let's say, hypothetically, if the United States did have 0% unemployment, what would happen to the economy?
That's hard to imagine because I can't. Can we do it more like if it went very low? I can't even wrap my brain around what.
All right. True zero. Impossible to even picture.
If you got an unemployment rate down anywhere near 0%, you're going to see dangerous effects of an overheated economy.
So right now, the unemployment rate is 3.9%. And if we got close to 0%, here's what that would mean. The minute you wanted a job, you just had one. No one would be unemployed, not even for a little while. And if you're an employer and you need to hire someone for a job opening, that would make things complicated because you'd have to lure away someone else's employee. And in order to keep your own workers and lure someone else's, you'd have to increase wages. which would be a good thing, more money. But if employers are constantly giving everyone in the country pay raises,
that employer may have to start increasing prices to cover the cost of those increasing wages. And those increases in prices, if it happens en masse, can lead to accelerating inflation.
Inflation, rising prices across the economy. And a little bit of inflation is okay. But in this world that we're talking about, it could be out of control inflation.
Right. Economists say we have to balance employment and inflation. And the perfect, ideal balance is called full employment. No one actually knows what the unemployment rate would be in that scenario, but Heidi says that full employment is when everyone who wants a job can find a job, but you may be unemployed for a little bit of time. So there is some unemployment, but the kind we're okay with.
So maybe we can tell Chris that full employment is kind of like economist zero unemployment?
And also that, Chris, you should not want the United States to achieve true 0% unemployment. That would not be a good thing for any of us.
Don't do it, Chris. Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, Allie.
All right, next up in the studio, we have Kenny Malone drinking tea.
I'm a little sick.
You're a little bit sick.
I'm so sorry for anyone who has to listen to this, but I think it will be worth your time.
Okay, what do you have for us?
Well, in the United States, Sally, you are aware that there are essentially two ways of getting housing. You buy property or you rent it.
Yup.
But our listener, Richard Leonars, was in South Korea recently and was interested in a potential third option, a system known as chunse.
Chunse.
That's right.
So, chunse can be translated as key money deposit.
Key money deposit.
Yes, key money deposit.
This is Professor Jung Sung Kim, who was born in South Korea and is now an economics professor at Bryant University in Rhode Island. And he told me chunse is kind of like a giant security deposit. If I want to live in your house, I hand over some lump sum of money. I move in, usually for 2 years. I don't pay you any monthly payments, nothing. It's just that lump sum at the beginning. And then at the end of the 2 years, I move out and you give me my money back.
Okay, but what if I, like, lost your money?
Well, luckily, I am living in collateral. Like, I'm living in your house. So there are protections. Maybe there's insurance or a lien or, worst case scenario, maybe I get a cut of the sale of your house. But hopefully, you will not lose my key money deposit.
Okay, so it ends up being, like, an interest-free loan from you, the renter, to me, the homeowner, with the house as the collateral.
Exactly. And it can be a lot of money up front.
Anywhere from 50% to 80% of the market value of the real estate.
Almost buying the apartment.
Right.
But without buying the apartment.
No. See, it sounds a little ridiculous, but there are reasons for this.
Jung Sung says this system made a lot more sense in the 1960s when home prices in South Korea were skyrocketing and banks weren't really giving out mortgages. Chunse developed this middle ground for people who couldn't afford to buy but didn't want to throw their money away in rent. And landlords loved this because they could take this key money deposit and then invest it. There were these insanely high interest rates at the time, like 25 to 30%.
It's the perfect match between the homeowner's needs and then the renter's needs.
One of the questions our listener had is whether or not this kind of a system would translate well into the United States.
I am a little skeptical.
Because he says, for starters, Americans just aren't familiar with it. It would probably be too weird. But if we could get over that, there's, like, where are you going to put the money if you're a landlord? Where are you going to get a good investment? You can't go get those 25% interest rates anywhere. So it's just too risky. Like, it's better just to get the surefire rent money. And by the way, this is true in South Korea as well. The chunse does not make nearly as much sense as it did in the 1960s, and John Sung suspects that it is probably on its way out. Still, good to know about.
Kenny Malone, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, but I actually need you to stay here in the studio.
But I'm
I know
sick,
you're sick
with tea.
But I need you because we're going to be doing a lot of math. I know you were a math major.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be good. Okay,
okay.
So,
let's do it. Let's do it. I'm in.
We got a two-part question from a listener named Ryan Heitner. Have airline life vests
ever saved a single life in the history of aviation? And how much do they cost?
Oh, I see. He wants to know, is it, like, worth it to be paying for these vests and then flying them all over the world?
Oh, yeah. He told me that he thinks it's not worth it. Okay. That's his suspicion.
Okay.
So I looked into this for him, and I talked to this guy named Harrow Ranter. He runs this big database of plane crashes, and he sent me a list of times when passenger planes have had to land on water in a sort of controlled way. It's called a ditching, and theoretically, that's when your life vest could come in handy, right? Because you might have some time to grab it.
Yeah.
So on this list, there are 43 cases of this in the last 50 years.
Whoa.
All kinds of planes, like small ones, only a few big commercial jets.
Okay.
But Harrow said, yeah, life vests have almost certainly saved lives in at least some of these cases. Now, if you're just talking about big commercial planes, it's more complicated, but history of aviation, definitely yes.
Okay.
Okay. So good. Now, yeah, good.
Good. We're not carrying them around for nothing.
All right. Now, cost. This turned out to be very complicated. Now, I talked to one major airline who told me that they get their life vests for $40 a pop and they last for 10 years.
So that is like a penny a day. That's 100% worth it.
Okay, whoa, whoa, whoa. There's a lot more to get through here.
Okay.
So I got in touch with Robin Riedel, who's a partner at McKinsey, who is an airline expert. He was like, you got to think about the fuel cost.
Right, the fuel costs.
Mm-hmm, because the more an airplane weighs, the more fuel it uses.
But how much does a life vest even weigh? That like barely weighs anything.
0.8 pounds, roughly, according to Robin.
Okay.
And so he calculates this, taking into account a bunch of stuff, including the density of jet fuel, which I thought was kind of cool. And it comes out to about 0.4 cents per vest per hour of flight.
Okay.
So then you multiply that by the average number of hours that a plane is in the air per day, which I got from MIT.
Of course,
and then you
of course.
Do that over 10 years and you get about
$133.59. $133.59 is the amount spent on fuel flying one vest around the world for 10 years.
Yeah, like typically on average for a commercial plane.
Such a delightful number to know.
Yeah, so you add that to the $40 that you spent on the vest initially, do some division, it comes out to about 5 cents per vest per day.
5 cents?
Mm-hmm.
5 cents to have a vest on my flight.
There is like some labor costs associated with it too because flight attendants have to check them. Because apparently sometimes people steal them,
that's
which I did not know.
Preposterous.
I know.
I'm so happy to be subsidizing, even saving one life in history. And even if it were zero, I'm pretty happy to pay a nickel just to have the theoretical life-saving device with me. Listener Ryan, do your own cost-benefit analysis based on that, but this is a no-brainer for me.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. It's pretty unlikely you're going to use it on a normal flight. There's a lot of planes out there. But I guess...
Sally, 5 cents.
5 cents. It's comforting to have a life vest for 5 cents. I think that's probably right.
I don't know. This is madness.
Okay. Kenny Malone, ladies and gentlemen.
Can I leave now?
Yeah.
With my tea?
Get out.
All right.
Okay. That was a lot of numbers. We need a break. After the break, we get existential. Where is the tariff?
This message comes from NPR sponsor, State Street Global Advisors. Download Crazy Enough to Work, a podcast series with Elizabeth Banks about the bold moves mid-cap companies make to thrive and survive. Provided by State Street Global Advisors Funds Distributors, LLC.
Tariffs are something that we have covered on Planet Money many, many times, but we have never, to my knowledge, touched a tariff. And we got a question from listener Steve Whitworth that basically asked us, when someone pays a tariff, where does the money go? And that got us thinking just like, where is the tariff in the most concrete possible way? And Stacey Vanek Smith is here with us.
Hi, Sally.
Co-host of The Indicator, Planet Money's daily economics podcast. And Stacey, I hear that you found the tariffs. You touched them.
This is true.
Ugh.
I found them and I touched them. If you want to do this, you go to Newark, New Jersey, to the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Building in Newark. And there, in this building, you will find a massive book. It is the Harmonized Tariff Schedule of the United States.
We love the Harmonized Tariff Schedule. It lists all the tariffs. It's more than 3,000 pages. It has everything you could import
yes.
into the United States.
The woman who showed us all of this information, by the way, was a woman named Linda Burke, and she took us through the tariff book from moon rocks to purses to shoes, the works.
Okay, so you saw the tariffs on paper, but, you know, we wanted more than just paper. We wanted to get closer to the money.
Where does the tariff happen? Like, let's say there's like a 20% tariff on sandals from China. Who pays that? When do they pay it? Like, how does that even happen?
After the merchandise is accepted into our commerce, the broker has 10 days.
So Linda explained that the tariff actually happens once the item has already arrived in the United States. The people on the hook for tariffs, the people who have to pay the government, are American importers who often pay through a broker. And they get something that is kind of like a credit card bill. So if it's like Sandals Inc. based in Tacoma, then Sandals Inc. will pay the import fee.
Correct.
And then who do they pay?
They pay the National Finance Center, CBP. Typically, it's done electronically. We see less and less checks every year. Cash is almost unheard of nowadays.
But it still happens.
Rarely. I would be surprised once or twice a year.
Tariffs and cash.
Oh, man. But it sounds like we didn't get to touch bags of cash at customs.
There was no bags of cash that they let us see. But they did say that they are electronically bringing in a ton of money. After the IRS, the CBP, the Customs and Border Protection, is the country's biggest revenue-generating agency. It collected more than $40 billion worth of tariffs last year.
That is a lot. To be fair, the IRS did bring in more than $3 trillion, but still, a lot. And okay, for the last part of Steve's question, where does that tariff money go?
That is an excellent question. It could basically go anywhere. It just gets put into the U.S. Treasury and becomes part of the money that the government uses to pay its bills.
So in a way, it's all around us.
In a way, it's everywhere.
Thank you, Stacey.
You're so welcome.
And listeners, to hear more of Stacey, please listen to The Indicator. Stacey hosts it with Cardiff Garcia. It is excellent, excellent, excellent.
Oh,
go check it out.
Sally Helm, you're making me blush.
Now, here with our last topic for the day, we have Bryant Urstadt, our editor. Bryant, hello.
Hi, Sally.
So shoot, what do you got on your mind?
Meg Larson sent us an email about a drive she took through Minnesota. And on the way, she notices something. There are all these huge, huge, huge RV, recreational vehicle, dealerships. And she wants to know, can there possibly be this many people buying RVs? Why are they so big? And it was something I've been wondering about, too. I have been driving by the same dealer in Massachusetts for literally decades, and I have always been amazed at how enormous it seemed. You drive for miles, there's nothing, and then there's just a field filled with RVs.
Huh. Okay. So massive RV dealerships across the country. What did you find out?
Well, it was pretty easy to find a person who knew the answer.
Yeah, I'm Kevin Broom. I'm the Director of Media Relations for the RV Industry Association.
Ugh, there's always an association when you need one.
And he said something that surprised me. He said, RV dealers really aren't that big. He says what Meg is experiencing is actually magic.
There is a little bit of an optical illusion effect.
And the dealers, they're kind of David Copperfields.
David Copperfield? Is he a magician? I thought David Copperfield was like a Dickens character.
Yeah, who later became a magician and had a huge television show in the 80s. Can the generations never talk to one another?
We're talking now. We're just not understanding each other.
Anyway, these dealers, they're a bunch of David Copperfields.
They put their biggest and highest end RVs toward the front of the lot. And so as you're driving by, it looks like there are a lot of them, but there aren't necessarily as many as you think.
So this is like the fake Western town in Hollywood?
Yeah, a little bit.
And I Googled that place in Massachusetts, and sure enough, right there on satellite view on maps, I could see it. There were not hundreds and hundreds of RVs as I had thought, but just like dozens strategically positioned so that from the road it looked like an endless field.
It's all a lie.
It's mostly a lie.
Thank you so much, Brian Urstadt.
You're welcome, Sally.
Send us more questions. We are planetmoney@npr.org. We are at Planet Money on Twitter and Facebook. And I want to ask, go follow us on Instagram. We've been posting a lot of new stuff there. It's looking really good. Check it out. Today's show was produced by Taylor Haney and Aviva DeKornfeld.
Our editor is Bryant Urstadt, and Alex Goldmark is our supervising producer. I'm Sally Helm. Thanks for listening.